Ray Johnson, and you can feel free to talk to him. He's a very, very close friend of a very close friend of mine.
Okay.
And
is he official or is he
No, no, he's official.
Okay.
Very official.
All right.
Okay, but we're going outside regular channels right now.
All right.
But you can talk to him, and he is definitely very official. He's from the department that we discussed before over the phone.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Hold on just a moment.
Michael.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, as good as can be expected under the circumstances.
All right. Well.
Listen, I got involved with the Wacken Hut Corporation, and I've been involved with them for approximately 25 years.
Uh-huh.
And Wacken Hut is a security service,
right,
the second or third largest in the United States, and they have their primary product is uniformed guard services. And hold on, I'm going to have to call you back. They just brought lunch here.
Oh, okay.
So I'll call you back in about 5 minutes.
All right, fine. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Anyway, Wacken Hut is a prestigious security firm.
Right, I'm aware of it.
On the one hand, they have uniform security guards at minimum wage or just above minimum wage level, which comprises of bulk of their employees.
Right.
On the other hand, at board of directors level, they have the retired heads of every government agency that there ever was. Including Clarence Kelly, former FBI director,
right,
Raleigh, Secret Service, Carlucci, Admiral Inman, you know,
mm-hmm,
Stansfield Turner.
Right.
It just goes on and on and on.
Right.
From an early age, I was connected with a man named Chuck Emmert, whose mother financed George Wacken Hut,
mm-hmm,
in starting Wacken Hut.
Mm-hmm.
I was a child prodigy, and at age 15, I was introduced to the man who was a co-inventor of the laser, Arthur Shalow,
mm-hmm,
a professor at Stanford. And at 16, I was at Stanford working with him in the laser department.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved in the counterculture, and I also got involved in some very high-tech research projects. I mean, I had everything, you know, that I could dream of. And I got talked into being an operative, you know, during the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran afoul of, you know, I was really too young to be involved in what I was involved in, but I ran afoul of a situation where two high-ranking officials covered up an investigation that involved a relative of somebody that was close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I made my presentation to the grand jury on the government side, I let the cat out of the bag. I was quite disturbed about it initially, and I went to the parties that were involved. They told me not to pay any attention to it. That was none of my business. You know, I was just to go in with the prepared, you know, testimony, and that was it. I went to another guy who's now deceased, unfortunately, who was with the ATF, and he told me that I had the right as a witness to address the foreman of the grand jury,
mm-hmm,
around the assistant U.S. attorney that was handling it. I did.
Mm-hmm.
It involved what happened was it clarified a misunderstanding which had been promulgated through summary and synopsis of raw files that went through the system.
Mm-hmm.
There were two people with the same name, the same first name,
mm-hmm,
different last names.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon the first names got merged into, you know, one person, and then the last name of the person they were trying to shield,
right,
you know, disappeared. The thing is the gal they were trying to shield was the person with the direct knowledge of the situation. And since it involved a serious matter, that being the Weather Underground bombing of the Pentagon, it was rather unprofessional at best, the conduct. And as a result, the investigation really died. And it was serious enough that it wasn't just a bunch of hippies involved in a protest, type, disturbance. This was a Monroe effect type explosive device that was planted in the janitor's closet of the woman's restroom in the Pentagon building. And it was directly above the meeting room where the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their aides were scheduled to assemble. The bomb went off prematurely and there was no loss of life. It was just a fluke, a miracle, however you want to ascribe, the way it went down.
Okay, but when was that?
Oh, that was in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was either late 69 or early 70 when that happened.
Yeah, because I was working then.
And anyway, that brought down some wrath on me in Seattle.
Okay, now, you did testify before a federal grand jury?
Yes, in Seattle, Washington.
All right.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And what had happened was when I let the cat out of the bag, it really embarrassed some people.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, I had provided technical assistance in a major undercover operation which nailed some the upper echelon in the Seattle PD on accepting payoffs. There were $500. Well, there were increments, depending on where you were in the chain, $500 envelopes, $1,000 envelopes, and then the top of the department, they were getting $1,500 envelopes. And I provided the buggy equipment
okay.
and the methodology. So I had a strike against me there.
Now, who is it that you were cooperating with then?
Well, this was through the intelligence unit, Seattle PD.
Okay.
And Friedel and Tredovic were my supervisors. And what had happened was none of these guys in the Seattle PD got any criminal sanctions against them. They were let go for 6 months without pay,
mm-hmm.
and then they were demoted one rank, and then their careers went back on track.
Right.
So at the time, I upset the apple cart over the daughter of, a prominent citizen.
Mm-hmm.
They were already laying for me.
Mm-hmm.
And after I walked out of the courthouse in Seattle, I was picked up by four of these guys. Major Wilding was one of them. Anthony Thomas was another. And Carl Jett, Detective Carl Jett was another.
Mm-hmm.
And they took me to Carl Jett's lake place in Seattle, beat the shit out of me, and said that I was going to be taught respect for law and order. And less than 90 days later, I was arrested on drug charges in Seattle.
Okay.
The interesting thing about it is that the guys that orchestrated it got greedy and took most of the materials that were supposed to be left on the scene. There wasn't enough to make a case.
Hmm.
90 days went on, there was no grand jury indictment, and they had to send them back in, and they put a pipe on the bottom of the Duwamish River with a float marker on it that indicated, where, the contraband was in the pipe, and the float marker, was so that after they got a search warrant, the divers would find it.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is the drugs that were in there could not have been made with the chemicals and by the methods that they said that I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs were of a purity. That product could not have been made in an underground laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many discrepancies and inconsistencies, it was just, incredible.
Okay, when was this?
This was in 1973.
All right.
I got a conviction on that, and I only did 13 months. What had happened was they sent me away because they thought I had psychiatric problems. During the time that I was arrested and I went to trial, there was really quite a drama. I went after the people who set me up.
Mm-hmm.
I nearly exposed them.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the home of a U.S. magistrate. I missed him at his office. And I had some tape recordings of people admitting to setting me up. And I had a tape recording of a federal agent giving instructions to some CIs on how to embroil me in an attempt to take the life of one of the witnesses against me.
Mm-hmm.
And I played the tapes to the magistrate, and the magistrate said it wasn't within his, you know, he advised me to go take it to my attorneys, so on and so forth. My attorneys couldn't believe any of this was real, and the court ordered a psychiatric evaluation of me. The first doctor they sent me to was a doctor who was a personal family friend of the main witness against me. And I objected to you know, going to this guy. As I predicted, it turned out to be a disaster. The second one that I went to gave me a glowing, you know, report, completely the opposite. So the government chose not to accept it. The third, the compromise they made was they had a panel, a new doctor plus the other two that had evaluated me, and they said that I had some emotional difficulties and some paranoid ideation, but I was competent to stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
I was not a danger to myself or others.
Mm-hmm.
And
now this is time.
This is back in 73.
Yeah, but it was served in.
This was federal.
Federal time.
Yeah.
Where did you do that?
Well, I went to Lompoc for study and evaluation, and
okay.
Then they sent me to Springfield, Missouri, after the trial. To be evaluated because they felt that I had these problems. I was making allegations.
Then where?
Pardon?
Then where?
To El Reno, and then I made contact with a Justice Department lawyer, gave him information on a major case in San Francisco that I'll get to in a minute.
Okay.
And then they shipped me to Terminal Island, which was my release point.
San Diego.
No, Terminal Island in Los Angeles.
Oh, in L.A.
Yeah, it's Long Beach.
Yeah.
Now, what had happened was in Springfield, within 5 working days, they determined that I did not have any psychiatric or emotional problems, that there was something suspicious with my case, and they wrote a recommendation to the judge that my case be reconsidered.
Okay.
That letter never got to the judge. Okay. At Springfield, the staff put me in touch with a Justice Department lawyer that interviewed me based on what had come out during my evaluation.
Okay.
They checked it out. They had another meeting with me at El Reno, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in and they took a deposition.
Okay.
As a result of that, the former head of the California State Narcotics Bureau and former deputy chief of the Joint Federal State Task Force, as well as the top narcotics enforcement officer in the city and county of San Francisco, went down.
Okay.
They went down, I think they all did at least 6 years. They were charged with taking bribes, providing information on pending investigations on a selected basis, and supplying raw materials, primarily to the Hells Angels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one certain particular, you know, group.
Mm-hmm.
It was mainly amphetamine-based materials
that
were allowing to slip through.
Okay.
Anyway, from a jail cell, I managed to open up that case.
Okay.
Judge Alfonso Zerpoli was the judge who heard it. William Browning Jr. was the AUSA that handled the case. William Browning's career took a nosedive. The judge received harassment after, you know, handling the case. And I was labeled as somebody who had political connections that ruined the names of those fine law enforcement officers. I can have Virginia McCullough fax Sherry a newspaper account of that you know, of that sort.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, I was released, and I went to work in outside of Bakersfield, California, at our family-owned mining operation, which was a clay mine. We manufactured a mined and packaged a oil absorbent and a cat litter clay material that was sold through all the major supermarket chains.
Mm-hmm.
And my friends at Wackenhut, they advised me just to cool out, you know, and work at a normal job for a few years. And then they would put me back to work. After I was at the mine for about 2 months, they started giving me consulting jobs,
mm-hmm.
You know, related to intelligence, you know, technical support in intelligence matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a budget to continue my research work, which I'd been doing at the time that I was arrested. And one thing led to another, and I got to the point where I made a breakthrough. And we took my work up to Hercules, California, and and we decided to sell the mine, get out of the cat litter business, and devote all of our resources to the research work that I made a breakthrough in. And we bought this facility in Hercules. It was the old Valley Nitrogen plant. At the time we bought it, it had 2,000 employees, and it had just been shut down, but it up until 3 days before we bought it, there were 2,000 employees working on this facility.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you this just to give you a feel for how large it was.
Mm-hmm.
We developed about 3,500 acres of the property to put new homes on. You know, made a bundle of money off of that,
mm-hmm.
and tried to develop a research center on the rest of the plant site. And we started getting military contracts, and really drew some interest. One day, we were purchasing parts at the local Radio Shack store. The next day, we had high-ranking military people running errands for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really an amazing transformation. And I came to the point to where I had to have a portfolio with security clearances.
Mm-hmm.
And I was starting to, you know, go through the procedure. I had some, it was a former admiral, a retired admiral that was working with me at that time, retired Admiral Henry A. Rankin. And he had a way to get me over the hurdle of conviction that I had. And we had a number of senior guys from Lawrence Livermore Labs that were going to vouch for me. And then all of a sudden, somebody from my past shows up at Hercules. And he knows all about what I'm doing, which kind of shocked me. And said that, you know, it's too bad I was living rather poorly. Obviously, nobody was taking me seriously. And he said that he had connections that could, you know, get me on the fast track. All I'd have to do is help their group out. And I told him, thanks, but no thanks. And the guy left. I immediately call my friends at Wackenhut, saying that this particular individual had caught up with me and knew everything about what I was doing. And I talked to Robert E. Chasen at Wackenhut through Chuck Emmert, and he said, it sounds like I've got a, you know, real problem, and that I need to go down and talk to John Nichols at the Cabazon Reservation, and he can, you know, help me out. It turns out, years later, I find that the party out of my past, his name was Ben Kalka, that showed up at Hercules, was actually orchestrated to come there by the Wackenhut people.
Hmm.
And, you know, I didn't, like I said, I didn't figure this out until the, you know, the smoke finally cleared.
Now, when you were at Hercules and took over this old Valley Nitrogen facility, you started doing business as something else.
Hercules Research.
Hercules Research, DBA, huh?
We Research and then Hercules Properties, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
Hercules Properties was the real estate end of it, and Hercules Research was the technical end of it.
Okay.
Now, we got financing through company that Ursula Peace was on, you know, board of directors, and some, you know, other rather high-powered people, and everybody was, you know, exceedingly excited about the profit prospects of the breakthroughs we were making.
Mm-hmm.
We had 28 contracts alone with the PRAM Project Office of the United States Air Force. PRAM is a banner research expediting group out of Wright-Patterson Air Force.
Okay, now this product that you were doing the work on, was this something that had exclusively for military application? Was
no, broad-based industrial applications also.
Okay.
It was energy transfer technology, and it was an extension of the work done by Oscar Blomgren Jr. and retired Admiral Rankin at Interprobe out of North Chicago. And they had a simple electrostatic heat transfer surface phenomena, and I generalized it, and I developed a full understanding of what the physics of the phenomena were.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made some breakthroughs and developed a bulk heat transfer technology, which had earth-shaking implications in lasers.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, the largest known laser was called the Thumper at Avco Everett, a company on the East Coast. And the application of my heat transfer technology to that laser turned it from an industrial cutting device into a weapons-type device, like something out of a science fiction novel.
All right.
The breakthrough was absolutely earth-shaking, and it you know, it, the guys at Livermore Labs were ecstatic. I don't want to say his name on the phone, but the chief project planner at Livermore for all the divisions, including the Z division, saw dog and pony shows at saw a dog and pony show at Hercules, and he said that I had to interface immediately with everybody. You know, put a priority on it, and I can put you in touch with this guy to, you know, verify.
All right.
Fred Quell from the Office of Naval Research came out. He was also head of the XRAN committee. XRAN is a scientific advisory committee to all of the intelligence agencies and all the military services. And Quell saw one particular demonstration and said that, you know, he said this was earth-shaking.
Okay. All right, well, I'll take your word for the...
Virginia McCullough has been in touch with Quell, and he verified everything I had to say.
Okay.
Quell also told the PBS Frontline news people that, you know, he had worked for me and for my deceased former partner, Paul Maroska, and gave the details, and, you know, everybody was stunned. And I would have brought Quell in sooner to establish my credibility, but I was unable to locate him. And PBS was doing a series on Gerald Bull, who was murdered in...
London. And yes, I know, the arms guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bull was working for Wackenhut in conjunction with a project that I was on. Anyway, this Calka shows up at Hercules, and he's quite menacing. And I'm a little freaked out, so the Wackenhut people steer me down to Nichols, and this is supposedly the only guy that can help me out, okay? I had been involved with Nichols at an early age. I met him through Chuck Emmert and the Wackenhut people, and I had worked with him in Chile in the 60s. I'd gone to high school at a boarding school that have a lot of kids from Central and South America, and I met the family of the Chilean ambassador, and they had used my contacts down there to develop a source down there. And when I was down there ostensibly visiting my friends, I did some work that later was of value when Allende went down. I built all the communications equipment, the radio links for the detonators when you know, that coup kicked off. Robert Chasen, who is currently on the board of directors of Wackenhut, at that time he was vice president of Chilean operations for IT&T Corporation. Dino John Pianzio was under him, but not you know, with IT&T. Chasen's corporate position was just a cover. He was actually station boss for the CIA for Chile. Pianzio was deputy station chief, and John P. Nichols was the field operations guy. And they brought me in to design some equipment which would work in the electromagnetic environment that they had down there. There was something unique about it. It's too involved to go into in this conversation. Anyway, that was my first taste of, you know, intrigue with those guys. And, you know, I was hooked. You got to realize that these were all top-notch people. You know, I was a kid, and I was on the fast track. They'd open doors for me. Anything I'd ever wanted from a technical standpoint, I, you know, was literally handed to me. Everything from equipment to contacts. And, you know, my, there should have been no end in sight for, you know, my career. And I had no idea, you know, the way these people really operated. But anyway, Chasen, you know, in good faith, from Chasen, I, now you got to realize Chasen was Commissioner of Customs during the Carter administration. And then he, after that, he, well, before Carter, before he was Commissioner of Customs, he was with Wackenhut. And then he, let's see, he went from IT&T to a private consulting position, then to Wackenhut, then to Commissioner of Customs, then back to Wackenhut, where he is today. So Chasen steers me to Nichols. And I go down to the reservation. This is in late 1979. And Nichols hears my story, and he sends word back to my dad through Chuck Emmert that he doubts that he can work with me, that I've got too many unsavory friends, and that I don't seem to intent on changing my lifestyle and not willing to drop my contacts. And my dad says, don't let it bother you. You'll be writing your own ticket. You know, the caliber of your work is, you know, they'll have to get security clearances to talk to you, not the other way around. And so I told Nichols that. No, I told Chuck Emmert that. And that I wasn't interested in any more of his help. And a week later, Nichols invites us back down to the desert. And he's got a solution to all my problems. And we signed this service contract. He's going to get me my clearances and get the problems of my past completely, you know, taken care of. On that service contract, it stipulates that if there's a disagreement that cannot be resolved through representatives, and my representative was my deceased, now deceased partner, Paul Marosca. John Nichols' representative was Alan Robert Fry, who at that time was vice president in charge of governmental and special services for Wackenhut. And, wait a minute, it was Peter Zukowski, former president of Armtec, was John Nichols' representative. If Zukowski and Marosca couldn't resolve any disputes that came up, then Alan Robert Fry was to take it, the one to take it to arbitration with the American Arbitration Society. And So I entered into this contract, and Nichols started performing. He got doors opened, he got me, clearances. And then we started a series of joint ventures between our company, Hercules Research Interprobe, and Cabazon Wackenhut joint venture. We had another one, Certec, which was between our company, Recovery Technology, Inc., and Sonoma Engineering and Research. Sonoma Engineering and Research was an outfit in Santa Rosa, California, owned and operated by Burl Barber, and it had it was a full classified military classified microwave specialty house.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was going huckledy-buck, and then Nichols and Zukowski contact me one day, and they suggest that in order to put the final touches that I on, cleaning up my act, that I cooperate with the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Against this guy that had started to bother me.
Okay.
Namely Kalka.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just follow along with what Nichols and Zukowski say. Paul Maroska goes along. And but Paul asked Peter to double check it. So Peter double checks it through his contacts. His wife was mayor of Indio at that time. And Indio, California was a city that was right next to where the tribal lands were.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter's wife knew the chief of police there. And the wife of the chief of police worked in the DA's office in Riverside County. They checked everything out. They said that, what Nichols was doing was on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, the FBI agent involved, Robert Barnes, was an upright guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I start going along with this sting program, and I don't want to go into the details of that because of where I'm sitting right now.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I cooperate with it 100%. And all of a sudden, things are dragging on, and they're not going the way they should. And Paul Maroska starts checking out Nichols, and he gets a private attorney, and the attorney does a background on Nichols and finds out some horrifying things about Nichols. He isn't all goodness and light.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, John P. Nichols is triple dipping in our ventures.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if the cash flow was up the way it should have been, and we had another 6 lean months ahead of us, that would have been okay, because he was wearing 3 separate hats.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Paul wanted him to cut back on one of the dips. Plus, Paul wanted a UCC filing on Sonoma Engineering and Research to protect our interests. And all of a sudden, Paul became a thorn in Nichols' side. And the last straw was Paul wanted his own private attorney to interject himself in the middle of the cooperative agreement that we signed with the U.S. government.
Right.
And Nichols just became furious at that. And this was right before the Christmas holidays.
Hmm.
And by that time, Nichols, the things that Nichols had began asking me to do were really suspect. And I was tense, Paul was tense, and my dad was a little suspicious also. And Nichols started shifting all the blame off onto Paul Maroska. And what had happened was, right after New Year's, Paul disappeared. And Paul had a meeting set up with a Phil Parath. And on, I think it was January 15th or 16th, when Paul didn't show up for that meeting, I knew that something was radically wrong. And I went searching for Paul, and I was the one who found his body. And Nichols managed to cover his tracks on this one to a point, and after about 2 months, it broke down. And I started having serious doubts, and at that point, I went directly to the FBI.
Okay.
And I told them what my feelings were, and I wanted questions answered about very questionable things that Nichols was doing. And at that time, Bill Rice, who was the supervisor out of San Francisco, told me that he was glad I came in because it probably saved my life, because I would have wound up the same way that Paul and Fred Alvarez had. Fred Alvarez was a deputy tribal chairman on the Cabazon Reservation that had challenged Nichols in 1980, and Nichols had successfully covered his tracks on that one. And it later turned out that the FBI knew the whole history of Nichols. Granted, he was connected as an intelligence operative with a long history of accomplishment. He also had a legacy of Murder One behind him. And he had union, contacts that went... And it was just a very ugly track record when you fly-spec the record on this guy.
Okay.
And somebody was obviously covering for him. It's the only reason why he could have survived without being indicted. We found at least 24 situations where, by all rights, cases should have moved forward against this guy, and for some reason, the cases never went anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Alvarez, after I finally found out that, or realized that Nichols was the one who orchestrated Marasca's death, and I started uncritically I stopped uncritically accepting everything that he and the Wackenhut people had told me. I started looking at everything, and I got together with some other people who were disaffected with the Wackenhut Cabazon situation, and we raised holy hell. Included among those people were Ted Gunderson, who was a former senior FBI guy. He retired in 78 as the SAC out of Los Angeles.
Yes, I know he is.
Ted, as a result of poking around in this stuff, had his career completely destroyed by disinformation. For example, Ted in 1983 came up into the Fresno area looking for some of my equipment that had been stolen in the aftermath of Paul Marasca's death. And all of a sudden wound up accused of being a major methamphetamine dealer. And Ted, through his contacts, found out who the informant was that they were, or who the cooperating individual was that was working with the authorities in Fresno to set him up. Through another contact, he got copies of handwritten notes of the agents instructing the cooperating individual as to how to maneuver and set Ted up on a telephone conversation. Ted, with another private investigator, tracked down the cooperating individual. The cooperating individual admitted that she was under a lot of pressure. She was facing extradition to Florida. Ted offered to help her out if she would pass a polygraph and a psychological evaluation. So he had a forensic psychologist and the polygraph specialist do a workup on her. She passed with flying colors, no deception indicated. And although she had some psychological problems, nothing that would detract from her credibility with the story that she was telling. So Ted goes to the judge, the district court judge, she was before on a local case that they were pressuring her on. He got that overturned. He told the judge what was going on. I've got the correspondence on that. Then they threatened her with the extradition to Florida. The district judge there, Judge Dahlman, and Ted contacted the judge down in Florida that had control over her case. He issued an order and dropped the whole thing. So this gal was, free. Ted then went to the state attorney general's office, and he went to the United States attorney general, raising holy hell. I mean, he had it in black and white, you know, what they had tried to do, I mean, and he demanded an explanation. John Vandekamp, who was a personal friend of Ted's, completely stonewalled him. Stephen Trott, who was formerly the U.S. attorney in Los Angeles,
yeah,
and was number three man, I believe, in the United States Department of Justice,
right,
completely stonewalled Ted, and they were personal, personal, close friends.
Hmm.
I mean, it was just, you know, incredible. From there on out, Ted had an FBI file generated on him, accusing him of all kinds of things, and it's been an uphill battle for Ted, you know, to try and straighten that out.
Mm.
And to this very day, he still hasn't overcome those difficulties. Now, someone like me, I can understand that happening too, but not a guy like Ted, okay?
Mm.
You know, Ted is for real a Dudley Do-Right type, you know, Boy Scout type of a guy. In fact, this really put him through a period of greening. You know, he was basically an administrator. You know, he was a good investigator, but he was strictly from an administrative standpoint. He had to learn the reality of the streets, trying to chase down the shadows in his life that were dogging him. And it's, you know, Ted's story is, you know, a story unto itself. Anyway, if it hadn't have been for Ted, I would have never survived this to the point that I have. Ted helped me really open up the situation on the Marasca killing and on the Alvarez killing. And he helped me get Nichols on solicitation of murder charges on five counts. Nichols pled out to two of them, and he only did about 12 months or so. And he had glowing letters of recommendation from, you know, politically prominent people. And, you know, he did his jail time, and then he went back to the Cabazon Reservation, and his sons now are fronting for him, but he's still in control down there.
Mm-hmm.
John Littman from the San Francisco Chronicle recently wrote a series of three articles raising the profile of the goings-on on the reservation. Sherry should have copies of those.
Okay.
Littman showed that there was $250 million worth of federal and state grants. There was $150 million in a power plant project. There was 700,000. There was two HUD block grants, one for $400,000 and some odd dollars, and another one for $700,000 for gambling operations.
Yeah.
Which is hardly the proper use of, you know, HUD funds. And it showed that Littman had reviewed over 1,000 government documents, as he states in the article, and interviewed scores of witnesses, including the DOD, Department of Defense, Cognizant Security Officer, for the clearances for, you know, that operation. And he saw that it was all real. And in my current case, which was generated out of me coming forward in federal court in Washington, D.C., on the Inslaw matter, and me coming forward to the House Committee on the Judiciary on the Inslaw matter, the government used my statements and affidavits as an indication that I might have serious mental problems to the point that I was incompetent to stand trial. The articles that Littman wrote made my affidavits in the Inslaw case very mild by comparison to what Littman stated. And basically got me off the hook on that one. And he did enough research. Six congressional hearings opened as a result of it, but they've gone nowhere. And how much storage space they have to accommodate the stuff. And other interested parties were out there looking for that stuff, pressing hard for it. Within 8 hours after I told Rice that in Oakland, California, Jim DeSilva, the custodian of the raw materials, was jacked up by Ben Kalka and company, and relieved of all the raw materials. His pregnant girlfriend was beat into having a miscarriage right in front of him. And, you know, he stopped being evasive with him at that point and, you know, just told him where they could go to get the stuff. And the FBI didn't even move on the stuff until almost a week later. By that time, you know, the stuff was long gone. Now, giving them the benefit of the doubt, I think that they were talking to other people besides just me. And I think in one of their interviews, Barnes and Villars probably over-communicated with another source.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, something that I had said,
well,
which might have tipped them off. That's giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Right, okay.
Except in the Fresno area, there was a group of people known as the Fresno Company. And the Bernard brothers were involved in it. Jamie Clark was involved in it. And all of these people seemed to have charmed lives. There was a major investigation on Jamie Clark in the Fresno area that never seemed to really, you know, go anywhere.
When was that?
Pardon?
When was that?
In 82 and 83.
Right. Now, this the Fresno Company, was that a just kind of a name that these people call themselves so that...
Well, it was a nickname.
Nickname, right.
They were originally out of Nancy, Kentucky, and Mena, Arkansas.
Okay.
And the Fresno Company, Brian Layton was the...
Oh, sure.
...was the assistant attorney. Now, Brian is now in private practice.
Yes, I know who he is.
And he really was the most effective person in formulating a strategy in the Justice Department to go after these people. He recognized what they were before what they are at that time. And there were a few ATF guys down in Los Angeles that recognized them for what they were. Okay, here was a group of over 300 people, most of them ex-law enforcement and ex-military, ex-intelligence type people involved in a major drug and smuggling operation.
Mm-hmm.
And they were involved in compromise activities. The bottom line was espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And all Layton served to do with his inroads that he made on prosecution, I think he served 28 or so indictments. All he did was vaccinate the group against further penetration.
Hmm.
Just hardened them.
Okay.
And all the major sources that were developed from inside all turned up dead.
Hmm.
A federal judge in Texas turned him dead.
Right.
Let's see, there was a local prosecuting attorney down in Florida that was shot in the face on his front porch, you know, shot dead. You know, literally his head was blown off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was a nasty, you know, bunch of people.
Right.
And they're still alive and well. And Layton gave us a declaration that I had been, extremely helpful, and he rated, you know, that in no uncertain terms.
Right.
He said that it couldn't go anywhere, not through any fault of mine, but because of the nature of the, you know, the entity. And in my present situation, we tried to table some things, which should have allowed me to walk, go into a protection program for my family. The government turned a deaf ear to. They said that what I had to say was fabricated and delusional, and that was all there was to it. And you know, and then later on they said, "Well, it may be true, but it can't be checked out. You know, so it's of no value." The fact of the matter is there are current cases being worked where some wiretap summaries have shown up. And the wiretap summaries validate my fear and my paranoia, as well as the scope and magnitude of what I was saying. In the application for the affidavit in application for one of the wiretaps, the FBI agents Marty Schwartz and Tom Gates, I believe they're out of L.A., they are bemoaning the fact that Robert Booth Nichols, one of the targets, through highly placed, high-level government contacts, is obtaining information on a continuing basis and leading into high-placed mob figures. And they name them. They also have intercepts, telephone intercepts, of where Nichols is talking to him, you know, leaking this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious that Nichols is, you know, somebody of stature. The investigation stemmed out of the Angelo Comito case in San Francisco in the AUSA that's handling that is Jeffrey Anderson. And even though the Comito pled guilty to one count of a 10-count indictment, there are still other matters that are going for continuing investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Comito case encompasses healthcare fraud as well as major stock fraud and involvement with the Japanese Yakuza as well as the mob in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Comes into you know, everything across the board.
Okay.
And it's pretty well spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
And Nichols somehow found out that Tom Gates was pursuing him. And the way Nichols found out was Gates made some inquiries in Japan. And Nichols was notified of it immediately. And Nichols started doing a study of Tom Gates, and then he filed suit against him.
Hmm.
And apparently, Gates did not go through the international liaison section when he made the inquiries overseas.
Mm-hmm.
It was a procedural error.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taken Gates to task, and he's been through the Federal Court of Appeals. It's been remanded back down to district court, and Nichols is suing him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of throwing water on their investigation, but it does not diminish, you know, the nature and the magnitude of, you know, what these guys are.
Well, correct. Correct.
The thing is Nichols has got juice. Now, where that dovetails into my current situation is in 1984, I was involved with with Robert Booth Nichols. There's two Nicholses here, I've got to clarify. There's John P. Nichols, who was known as Dr. Nichols, who was on the Cabazon Reservation associated with Mackinac.
Mm-hmm.
There was Robert Booth Nichols, who has his own company, Meridian Arms Corporation, and was a principal in FITCO, which is First Intercontinental Development Corporation. The CEO of FITCO was George.
Oops.
George was a former CEO of Burns and Rowe Corporation. They built the Savannah River Nuclear Project.
Okay.
Bob Mayhew was vice president of FITCO.
Mm-hmm.
Franny Fox. A whole host of notables,
right,
you know, were on it. FITCO was an NSC corporate cutout.
Mm-hmm.
FITCO was created to be the corporate vehicle to secure the financing for the reconstruction of the cities of Beirut, Lebanon, and Ad-Damour, Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And they were working out of an office in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I got involved with Robert Booth Nichols at Meridian Arms Corporation. And Meridian Arms Corporation was fully licensed by the ATF for machine guns, destructive devices, and ammunition for destructive devices to both, you know, to manufacture and possess and transport, all of the above. And here again, I got involved with a group of people that were all high profile and should have been, you know, above reproach. FITCO had a companion company called Urimay Trading, which operated throughout the Middle East. And I came in contact with the Promise Software. Urimay had a distribution contract with several Arab countries. And I was asked to look at evaluate the hardware platforms that they had chosen. That was IBM AS400 stuff.
Okay.
That had come from IBM Tel Aviv, but it came through a cutout, Link Systems, because they couldn't deal directly with an Israeli,
right, you know,
position.
Right.
Link Systems was a cutout there. And I came across a guy named Michael T. Hurley, and I thought he worked for the State Department, you know, and I thought he worked under Vic Dicus, of the State Department. It turns out that Hurley was in-country attaché for the DEA in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the DEA had no real presence in Lebanon.
Right.
Neither did anybody else.
Right.
Okay. Including the Israelis. You know, they had their usual, network of contacts, but it was very ineffective.
Right.
The only way to penetrate that situation was to get into the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
And Urame got into the drug trade. And I was told that it was a fully sanctioned NSC-directed operation. Which it turns out it was. I've got about 20 affidavits. One is from a legal attaché for the NSA. One is from a legal attaché for the DIA. And this is all getting in an unrelated case, the Pan Am 103 bombing.
Mm-hmm.
All of those operations were bona fide, and all the people who were in them were definitely government people, although they were not who they said they were.
Mm-hmm.
They all worked for different agencies other than was stated. Probably part of the normal disinformation that goes,
right.
with that. So if there were any leaks, they can always, they tell different story, cover stories to different people.
Right.
And then they compartmentalize it that way. Anyway, I was a technical advisor for FITCO, and we had auspices through the government of Lebanon, to get in and out of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as going into the eastern part of Lebanon, unless you were connected with the drug trade, you could not, even if you went into the government group, your chances were slim, grim, and none.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out unscathed.
Right.
And so they forcibly recruited this one individual. I don't want to say his name. So it was
All right.
But they used modern technology to come up with compromise material, showing that this individual was collaborating with the Israelis on something.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have meant his death and the death of his family.
Mm-hmm.
So they started to build a network, and they further compromised their targets that they were turning with video and audio and photographic evidence. And at that time, I got involved with the production people, and I learned the wonders of the Cytex response system, which is an electronic airbrush system for photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And military photo interpreters cannot tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
There now are digital techniques, sophisticated digital techniques, to where you can tell if a photograph has been manipulated by the Cytex system. Same thing with video and audio. And there was a guy in London who was in the technical brains behind all of this, and I was just really amazed at the capabilities. And it worked. Built a network throughout the Bacaw Valley.
Right.
And then Nichols, who he is, Bob Nichols, he is under Harold Akimoto. Harold is from the Hawaiian Islands, and he runs the show in the Hawaiian Islands. And when I first met Harold, he was represented to me as being an intelligence person, which in fact he is. He has worked under Carlucci's auspices for many years. Apparently, Harold performed services for the U.S. government during World War II. He's of Japanese ancestry. And, I guess he was rewarded for services well done. Anyway, Harold controls everything in the Hawaiian Islands. Harold is rather legendary. When the traditional mob people tried to move into the Hawaiian Islands in the 60s, they were rebuffed rather brutally. And as a result, they could come to the Hawaiian Islands. visit, you know, unmolested. They can't do any business over there. If they have business elsewhere passing through the Hawaiian Islands, they can pay a little service charge or a tax.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, Harold, whenever he goes to any of the casinos, gets everything comp. Harold also has a contract for all the condiments in all the casinos in Atlantic City, Renus and Reno and Vegas. By that I mean all the cigarettes, candy bars, chewing gum.
Right.
And it's done through a company called Island Tobacco Corporation out of the Hawaiian Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold also sells all the condiments to casinos in Macau, China.
Mm-hmm.
He's got contacts in Honolulu, throughout the Orient, a couple of casinos in Bangkok. And there's a casino in a city about 15 miles north of Beirut that, Harold has his fingers in.
Mm-hmm.
When FITCO was doing the wheeling and dealing on financing for the reconstruction of the infrastructure of Beirut, and the brother of the president of Syria, Assad, Refat Assad was his name, wanted to get a toehold in the business in Lebanon that the Jafar family, had control of. So the intelligence folks, in their infinite wisdom, decided to capitalize on the long-standing battle between Refat Assad and his group and the Jafar family. Selectively, they were backing both people, okay, but they were playing them off against one another, developing networks. They got a bunch of prominent Syrians, thoroughly compromised, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they were in tow, in the intelligence game. And we had people that could get in and out of the Bekaa Valley, in and out of certain areas of Syria.
Right. Okay.
From an intelligence standpoint, it was a success.
Mm-hmm.
But to maintain the credibility of those intelligence operations, the heroin had to flow to make it real. And the stuff was starting to accumulate in a warehouse outside of Larnaca,
Cyprus.
And I personally was in a warehouse where Hurley told me there was, and George Markobi and George Pender told me there was upwards of 22 tons.
Hmm.
And even though it was packaged for shipment, the smell of it, was in that closed warehouse was just, was just overpowering.
Right.
Okay. White heroin like that, Middle East heroin, has a certain, odor because of the way it's processed.
Chemical process, yes, I'm aware of it.
And what they were doing was they had authorization for what they call controlled deliveries into the United States.
Right.
And they would target certain, cities, and then they would follow the stuff out, and then they would ostensibly find out the network, unmask the network, and, do a lot of prosecutions.
Right.
Then they would take care of the, the sourcing.
Right.
The only thing is they were doubling and tripling, sometimes even quadrupling their controlled deliveries. And at a certain transfer point, the excess baggage would be diverted, and then the original controlled delivery could be allowed to go through.
Right.
And at transfer points, now in the airport in Larnaca, I've got the names of the Cypriot narcotics people, that were handling it. And there's a couple of guys that are on the up and up, and they had suspicions, okay?
All right.
There was another agent, intelligence agent that worked with us, who's now deceased. His name was Tony Asmer. And he got onto it early on and started going toe-to-toe with Hurley. And he died in a bomb blast and it was ascribed to terrorists. Okay, and it was actually terrorists that did it, but his cover was deliberately blown. And myself and others suspect that Hurley and Bob Nichols and Glenn Chocolate were responsible for that.
Okay, now how does all of this bring you to where your current state of affairs here?
I broke away from Nichols.
Okay, all right.
Late 84.
All right.
The guy nearly got me terminated. At the time I was working with Nichols, we had a proposal to FMC Corporation, which is Food and Machinery Corporation, Northern Ordnance. They produce a Bradley personnel carrier.
Right.
I've got document of complete paperwork trail on the technology that was being presented.
Right.
We did a test demonstration of an enhanced air fuel device that I had developed. And we also did a test of a hydrodynamic implosion type explosive device. The implosion device settled the Nevada test range by about 30 feet. And Bob Nichols, when he had the Gallup Ordnance, well, the Lawrence Livermore Labs and the Gallup Ordnance people built the device, they overbuilt it because they wanted an impressive demonstration. Created an international incident. Anyway, my bona fides were established. The next thing was, let's get the business done and get Michael in harness in a program.
Okay.
And I was all for it.
All right.
Except Bob starts getting spooky on me. And he wants me to set up our end of it offshore, okay, in Singapore. He wanted to receive $20 million in cash, you know, in Singapore. And he wanted to use certain of the technology overseas, namely in Australia. Okay, I've got the paperwork trail. And he's just not being realistic. And he's starting to get drunk. He's under... Excuse me. He's obviously under a lot of pressure from somewhere, but his facade of respectability starts cracking.
Okay.
About that time, I find out that Harold isn't who Bob said he is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm really, but, you know, they're all definitely connected. There's no question about it. Bob really starts pressuring me with doing things a certain way.
Okay.
First of all, we had been approved at port level at FMC. We still had to go through the legal department, and then the FMC is a publicly held stock corporation. We still had to go through the shareholders. We were 8 months, a year away from consummating the deal.
Okay.
I asked Bob for some extra money to meet my, everyday expenses. And Bob said, no, hurry up and get the business done, and then you'll have plenty of money. And I tried to explain to Bob that there was no way he could expedite this thing, and I couldn't hold out. And I had some major expenses coming. I had a stepson that I had to put in special schools. And so on and so forth.
Right.
And Bob started becoming really overbearing. And then when he demanded that I state things in the contract proposal to FMC, which would have been, to the point of being illegal, that's when I really started to have second thoughts about it. There were other people involved in the development of that technology. Bob wanted me just to pay him out of my share, okay, and make no reference to them in an agreement. But when you've got the University of California and the University of Chicago having 16% of your company, you know, they had 16% of the Hercules Research Interprobe, how can I misrepresent or fail to represent that when I'm dealing with a U.S. publicly held corporation? Max Wildman, who is the CEO of Worthington Corporation, a big industrial manufacturing company, he has some stock in Interprobe and Hercules Research. Hold on. So I walked out on Bob, and Bob put the heat on me, and they wouldn't leave me alone. When I got remarried, they continued to harass me by putting in false intelligence reports of law enforcement. They blamed the screw-up on that sting operation on me. They told law enforcement I was running around with 300,000 pounds of fecal salicylic acid, which is a drug precursor,
mm-hmm.
and 1,255 gallon drums of monomethylamine. And, you know, that raised the eyebrows of the authorities, and I couldn't understand why I was being dogged. And, but if I was a narcotics agent and I got a raw, you know, report like that, you know, I'd be a little excited.
All right.
And so I was in the process of starting to clean things up, and then the Hamiltons pursued me with a private investigator on Inslaw, and I didn't want to get nailed for piracy of that software. So I talked to my attorney, who talked to their attorneys, and I gave them a declaration. And about that time, Peter V. Nichols, who was an associate of Nichols, John P. Nichols, as well as Robert Booth Nichols, got a hold of me and told me I was my own worst enemy, and that if I didn't cool it, and if I didn't stonewall any further sessions or any further requests for information from the House Committee on the Judiciary, I was going away forever. And I told Peter, I said, look, I've already signed the declaration. You know, Hamiltons are going to come after me for, you know, piracy, you know. And he says, well, you're your own worst enemy. You know, 7 days later, I'm arrested on these charges.
All right, which are? What are the charges now?
I got 10 counts of drug-related charges, okay? And the chief witness is a guy that I wouldn't give the time of day to. I mean, the guy has been a witness with my wife's ex-husband in a nasty child custody case.
Okay, now these drug cases, is this a federal case?
Federal.
DEA?
DEA. Now, guess who had control of my case until the arresting officers actually put the handcuffs on me? Michael Hurley. And he came from his assignment in Lebanon to Seattle, and he came here specifically to get me, and he told numerous people that.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's where I stand.
Okay.
The guards just came in and said that I've
got to go. Well, I'm going to check a lot of this material that we've talked about, and there probably is a way that I can get back in touch and make make another contact to clear this up.
Yeah,
whatever needs to be cleared up.
I've just really kind of been a scatternet approach.
That's okay. That's all right.
I can pin it down, chapter and verse.
All right.
Okay.
Very good.
All right. Gotta go.
Yeah. Bye.
Convinced Ted that I was guilty, and my attorney, and then I got him turned around a little bit today, and I put on some witnesses. But I've got like the Keystone Cops working on my defense, and you know, it's really an ordeal.
Have you had any communication with Bobby today at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Have you talked to your friend again?
Yes. Not giving me much information. He's still, you know.
The circumstances of the arrest was, I transferred a bunch of money, and it turned out to be government money. Now, tell your friend at the end, not only am I willing to polygraph, but I need some expert help, and I think he needs some expert help. And in the league we're playing in, just put it to him precisely this way, verbatim, in the league we're playing in, the only guys we can get that have the wherewithal are with FinCEN, F-I-N, capital F, small I, small N, capital C, capital E, capital N. That stands for Financial Crimes Enforcement Network.
Okay.
Okay, now that's a banner. Tell them it's a banner ETF. Get me a technical guy that speaks my language. Okay? I'm talking about... I'm talking about Swift Chips.
Okay.
Capital SWIFTCHIPS. The CHIPS stands for Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System. Okay? I'm mad. Okay? I'm real mad. The government today, they've got all my files and records. They brought my computers in, less the cables to connect up the drives and stuff, less all of my optical storage disks.
Yes?
Tell your friend that each one of those optical storages, there was over 130 of them, contains 20,000 plus pages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Tell them, I've got other ways of, you know, doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They jack me around so bad. Tell them, get an expert that speaks my lingo,
mm-hmm.
and I will tell him everything I know, and he can do so much damage, they won't need my testimony or anything else. They, you know...
Okay, everything you know about what?
Tell him it goes all the way back to the Cayman Islands and the Bahamas with Castle Bank and Savings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Norm Casper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the FinCEN people will be able to, you know, pin that down. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Resorts International thing.
Mm-hmm.
Goes into to Wackenhut and Stedman Securities.
Mm-hmm.
And the reinsurance business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
how'd you get this stuff? How come it's in your computer?
Not in my computer. You gotta realize, I was a kid. I handled the money for them. Okay.
For who?
The Wackenhut people.
Okay.
For Norm Casper.
Okay.
Tell them Norm Casper was, or you know, was a Wackenhut employee during all of this.
Okay. Okay?
Now, with the Workers' Bank in Colombia, I just noticed it's just Workers' Bank, but it's Banco de la Trabajadores. Okay. Tell them my Spanish is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Banco de la Trabajadores.
Trabajadores.
Okay, I just noticed the Workers' Bank.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because that's, okay. Now, tell the guy...
What does that have to do? What about that?
Well, they'll know, okay? Now,
You know what? You have money transfers? You have this type of...
I set up their network.
Okay.
I set up their virtual debt drops.
What's that?
Virtual debt drops, okay?
What's that?
It's a way to get around reconciliations on ACHs.
Okay.
It'll take an... You know, I can't even talk to a normal human being.
I understand.
That's
I understand.
That's the FinCEN that will speak my language.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
You know, it's a virtual debt drop.
All right.
That's a way to get around ACH reconciliations on a daily basis.
Okay.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And, now, the bottom line here is, okay, Bob Nichols and Gilbert Rodriguez,
mm-hmm.
Michael Abel, who's now an attorney in D.C., but he was with the criminal section of the Justice Department,
mm-hmm.
and Harold Akimoto,
mm-hmm.
and Jose Londono. L-O-N-D-O-N-O,
uh-huh.
and Glenn Shockley
uh-huh.
are all in bed together, okay?
Okay.
Now, Ted Gunderson...
Got any kind of paperwork on that?
No, wait a minute.
Okay.
Gunderson was physically with me, okay?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
When Wayne Reeder, Peter Zukowski, and his wife,
uh-huh.
several of Wayne Reeder's lieutenants...
R-E-E-D-E-R, he's the big...
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Several of Reeder's lieutenants...
Right.
You know, Bob Nichols and his wife,
mm-hmm.
Harold Akimoto,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, myself,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
George Pender,
mm-hmm.
Deborah Pender,
mm-hmm.
Bill Pender,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
we're all together.
Where?
Down at Wheaton Reeder's Country Club, or Golf Club,
uh-huh.
Golf Course, Country Club in Indio, California.
Okay.
And, Ted... Bob has discussed openly. Bob
and Ted was present there, right?
Ted was present.
Okay.
And so was my ex-girlfriend. But listen, Bob openly bragged about Glenn Shockley and Jose Londono having 7,000 soldiers. No, wait, it was 3,500 soldiers then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's now almost double that.
What does that mean? What are the soldiers?
Your guys, they'll know what it means.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
I was physically there, and so was Ted, and Ted can't deny that, okay?
Okay.
Now, at that time, after I had the break...
When did this take place, approximately?
It took place in 1983. Now, I have correspondence on things that we were doing.
Yeah.
Okay? I was in fear of my life because Bob was starting to act irrational.
Right.
Anyway, that's what happened to me there, and I've been on the run ever since then. Nichols turned on me. Okay, uh-huh. The guy was getting drunk all the time.
Bob. Right.
Waving a gun out the window, shooting in the air,
uh-huh.
You know, just
uh-huh.
really doing a mind trip on me.
Okay, let me bring something up to you now.
Okay.
Nichols, I've done a lot of, I've done some big investigation through an LA Times reporter friend of mine. He's
okay.
checking this out. Nichols and this Giaquini and this Jack Valenti that Nichols was passing these stories on to,
yeah.
They're both MCA.
Jack Valenti and Mr. Giaquina.
Do you know anything about them?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Now, let me ask you these questions, because you may have to hang up before I get everything out to you. So I'm going to ask them to you now, and then if you can't answer them all today, you can answer them next time you call me. And I'm going to read them all real quick, and then you can answer. What is Morganti code? What is CQ code? Ever heard of Wa Littrell? That's what Nichols says was the code name for Lebanon. Or Peter Vidnik's or Michael...
La Littrell?
Uh-huh. Wa Littrell.
How do you spell that?
W-A-L-I-T-T-R-E-L-L.
What?
Wa Littrell. That's how he pronounced it. I don't know how it's spelled.
Wa Littrell.
Yeah, Wa Littrell.
Okay. Wa Littrell is Casino du Liban. Okay?
Casino? What was that again?
Liban.
L-I... Okay.
It's in a little city north of Beirut.
Okay.
Okay, now explain to him that it's a casino there. You know,
okay.
Okay. Explain to him, Island Tobacco sells all the cigarettes there.
Okay.
Okay,
okay. Very good. Okay.
Now, Harold Akimoto and Bob are Island Tobacco out of the island.
I got that. I've already got
now,
that.
The Island Tobacco provides all the condiments for all the mob's casinos.
I know that, too.
Okay,
I know that.
But here's a tie, and this goes back to Hurley.
Okay.
And the boys, okay?
Okay.
Now, did they get this off a wiretap?
What?
No,
Nichols told it to me himself.
Why?
Because I'm really pushing him hard.
Why did he tell you that? In what context?
I asked him if you had ever been in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And he said, absolutely not. And he says, I've got all the notes. I don't want to waste the time to read them to you over the phone. But anyways, it was pertaining to... I simply asked him if you'd been there and led around. I never disclosed anything, nothing. I simply asked if you'd been there. And then he says, I said Michael said he was there. And I didn't say why. I didn't go into any details at all.
Okay.
But he says, what was the code name? And I said, I don't know. I said, what was your code name? He says, he was there too. And I said, what was your code name? He said, Wa Littrell. He says, was that Michael's? I said, I don't know. And he says, well, what was Michael's?
Did you say Wa Littrell?
Wa Littrell.
Yeah.
And I said, he says, what was Michael's? And I simply said, oh, it's in the notes somewhere. I don't know where. But I was lying through my teeth.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to see if you knew it, if you knew what it meant, because that's what he said it was.
You're talking about that was for the casino. He's giving you a little disinformation.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. I just...
friends tell you where the casino... I can't remember right now where that city is, but it's north.
Let me get on with the rest of the questions.
Okay.
Okay. Were Peter Vidnik's or Michael Hurley associated with FIDCO?
No. Urame Trading...
Okay. And how is Urame spelled?
U-R-A-M-E.
A-M-E. Okay.
Yes,
very good.
And it's Trading... Limited.
Okay, Urame Trading Limited. Do you have a location?
Okay, it was out of Nicosia, Cyprus, and the DEA had a house, I think it was on Columbus Street. Okay?
Okay.
And it was, you know, an apartment. Now, at this condo, they had a ham radio station there.
Okay.
This was
right.
A DEA, you know, office and
right.
nest there.
Okay.
And it was an ICOM, you know, single sideband amateur radio setup with a linear.
Were you there? Were you actually there physically?
I'm describing stuff and the setup of the house.
And you were there? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
Okay, on the top floor,
uh-huh.
Okay, I can describe the antenna system, you know, the way it's wired up and everything.
Very good. Is your...
ICOM, it was, you know... Unless you were there, you wouldn't know it was ICOM equipment.
I can get that,
that
later.
That was non-standard from what
okay.
was used in the other location, okay?
Was Urame connected to FIDCO? Is there any way to show the connection?
FIDCO's big time.
Yeah.
I've got all the board of directors of FIDCO.
Okay, now.
But what's the connection,
government I had on my files at the house?
Right.
The thing is, I can reconstruct my files. If I have help from the FinCEN people,
right.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Tell them that I need two types of computers. I need a VAX 11730. With set up with two RLL2 disk, one RA80, and a TU80 tape drive.
Okay, that's what I needed to ask you about.
Now, wait a minute. That's one package, and then I need a VAX 3900 computer. Now, the reason why I need the older, slower VAX, okay,
uh-huh.
And I know where to get all this stuff, okay,
uh-huh.
No problem. I just need to give them the information where the people are. I've got the VAXes in, Southern California, but I need a place to set them up and somebody to operate them and just follow my instructions.
All right.
Now, the VAX Series 3900 machine,
uh-huh.
Okay,
uh-huh.
It's too complicated to go into what mass storage devices,
uh-huh.
But those are the two levels of machines that I need.
Are they in Southern California, what you're asking for here?
Yes.
Do you want?
I know an equipment dealer who will work with us, who's the big aftermarket VAX guy in Salt Lake City.
Okay, I'm thinking about going down to visit your wife and bringing her and the kids up here. If I do that, do you want me to bring those computers up here?
No.
No, leave them where they're at.
No. Tell your friend to find somebody from FinCEN.
Okay.
If we move them around, we're going to wreck them.
All right, okay.
Find an expert at FinCEN.
All right, I will.
Okay, and tell them all.
Where would be a good place to find one?
Well, FinCEN is the ATF. Your guy's going to have to go through his contacts. He'll know what you're talking about.
Right, okay.
Okay?
Now, let me get on with the question.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Let me give you the background. I'm, since Bob brought it up and is playing cute.
Uh-huh.
That casino, okay,
mm-hmm.
They were posing as, a heroin outlet, to make inroads into... The guard's bringing me something. I got a hypoglycemic snack here.
Oh, good.
Anyway, the game plan with Urame and with Hurley's operation, okay?
Yes.
You gotta understand that the airport in Lebanon was closed down.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You take the ferry,
mm-hmm.
from Larnaca to Junia,
mm-hmm.
okay? Now, Junia was slightly south of where the casino city was, and the casino city was intact. Beirut was a nightmare.
Okay.
Okay, and so was Damour.
Mm-hmm.
Beirut and Ad Damour. Okay, those two cities were nightmares because the PLO destroyed the infrastructure by burrowing bunkers and
mm-hmm.
No water, electric, or phone.
Mm-hmm.
Combat
mm-hmm.
zone.
Mm-hmm.
The casino, the Syrian mob controlled it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can give you the names of the families. They pitted them off against one another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Who are the names of the people that you worked for over there?
Okay. There was a guy named, the main guy was Maurice Ganem. G-A-N-E-M.
All right.
Okay. Now, he has a relative who's either a brother or a cousin who is a senior DEA guy.
Okay.
I can't remember. If I think about it, I can remember his name. But Maurice was agency,